Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles from the online edition of the Atlantic Magazine. All of the articles were published in March of 2024. Here's a sample of some of the titles that we're going to cover today. Trump repeats Obama's mistake. The return of measles. Marriage proposals are stupid. And QAnon for wine moms. So I hope you enjoy the program today. We'll begin with Trump repeats Obama's mistake. Political parties suffer when their focus narrows to the presidency. By David A. Graham. Donald Trump has long detested Barack Obama and sought to present himself as the opposite of his presidential predecessor in every way. But in his takeover of the Republican National Committee, he risks echoing one of Obama's biggest political mistakes. Last night, Trump's hand-picked leadership of the RNC took charge and conducted a purge. The new regime, led by the new chair, Michael Whatley, the vice chair, Laura Trump, and the chief of staff, Chris LaCivita, fired about 60 employees, about a quarter of the staff, as part of, quote, streamlining. The bloodbath includes members of the communications, data, and political departments. Insiders told Politico they anticipate that existing contracts with vendors will be voided. When the new leaders were announced last month, I suggested that the GOP was ceasing to function as a political party and becoming another subsidiary of Trump, Inc. But there is another way to view it. For years now, the RNC has struggled. Republicans might have lost the 2016 presidential election if not for the emergence of Trump, who shook up the party's longtime platform and forged a new coalition, turning out voters no other recent candidate had. Since then, however, Republicans have continued to lag, even with Trump juicing turnout. Republicans got slammed in the 2018 midterms, lost the 2020 presidential race, and missed expectations in 2022. Special elections have been a Democratic playground. The RNC is entering the 2024 election with a third of the Democratic National Committee's reserves. From this perspective, it's about time that Trump took charge and cleared out the deadwood. Allies such as Charlie Kirk and Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene were jubilant at the overhaul, although Trump's opponents of his daughter-in-law and a top campaign aide are unusual, nominees typically take over the campaign apparatus ahead of a presidential election, the better to align aims. Truth be told, Trump can't really distance himself from the recent mismanagement. The deposed chair, Ronna McDaniel, was Trump's pick in 2017, and his main complaint about her is that she was insufficiently compliant. If Trump just wants more of the same, that's bad news for the party. Trump critics within the GOP also fear that he intends to use the party coffers as a personal defense fund, underwriting his substantial legal bills. Last week, the committee pointedly rejected a proposal by an old line member to prevent that. Let's take the best case scenario for Republicans, though. In the past, the RNC seemed like the professionals compared with the chaotic, amateurish Trump campaigns of 2016 and 2020. There's a reason Trump resorted to appointing RNC Chair Reince Priebus as his first White House Chief of Staff, despite his representing the establishment Trump hated. This year, however, the Trump campaign has seemed organized and disciplined, and La Civita is reportedly a big part of that. National committees tend to be bloated and old-fashioned. A more focused, streamlined operation could fix what ails the GOP. The problem is that Trump sees his own success and the success of the Republican Party as bound up together. But some things that are good for Trump are not good for the Republican Party over the long run. This is where Obama offers a cautionary tale. When he won the Democratic presidential nomination in 2008, Obama was an insurgent. The DNC had long been dominated by allies of Hillary Clinton, whom he defeated in the primary. He wasn't as deeply embedded in the old way of doing things. Obama viewed the Democratic Party as essentially a national organization, with the goal of supporting his political goals and his re-election. Upon winning the presidency, he moved key DNC functions to Chicago, his hometown and political base, despite the protests of party insiders, who worried that down-ballot efforts would be overshadowed by Obama's re-election campaign. He also created a group outside the DNC, Organizing for America, to support his political movement. The result was a badly weakened DNC. The national focus led to a neglect of other elections. After Senator Ted Kennedy died, Democrats managed to lose a 2010 special election for his seat in Massachusetts, of all places, a failure that some Democrats blamed on the National Party. The loss delayed the passage of the Affordable Care Act and required congressional Democrats to water it down to pass it. The Bay State Special was a harbinger. As Matt Yglesias calculated, in 2017, the Obama years saw Democrats lose 11 Senate seats, 62 House seats, and 12 governorships. The damage was especially bad at the state level. Democrats lost nearly 1,000 seats in state legislatures, the worst loss since Herbert Hoover dragged down the GOP. Republicans captured 29 separate chambers and gained 10 new trifectas, control of both chambers of the legislature and the governor's mansion. All of this happened at the same time that Democratic presidential candidates won the national popular vote in the 2008, 2012, 2016 presidential elections, as they would again in 2020. Democrats, including Obama, suffered for their missteps. As the Obamacare experience shows, it's harder to push a policy agenda when you lose elections. Losing control of the Senate makes it difficult to confirm judges, especially to crucial spots such as the Supreme Court. Just ask Justice Merrick Garland. And implementing policy is challenging if governors and state houses are working against you. An excessive focus on presidential races is also the danger of Trump's RNC takeover. He and his aides have announced that, like Obama, they see the party committee as basically an instrument for the presidential election. Our mission is straightforward: maximize the Republican Party's resources to get President Trump elected, La Civita told the New York Times last month. Echoing Obama's Chicago move, the RNC is reportedly already moving most of its operations to Palm Beach, Florida, near Trump's Mar-a-Lago headquarters. All of this makes sense. Trump is a narcissist who can't and won't separate his self-interest from the parties or the nation's. slashing the national footprint of the RNC may weaken the party at lower levels. Several state parties are already a mess. The chair of the Florida GOP was recently ousted amid a sex scandal. Michigan's GOP chair, a fervent Trump backer, was also deposed after a tumultuous stint, and the state party is reportedly broke. The Arizona GOP also recently lost its chair and has been racked by feuds. But more MAGA is unlikely to be the solution to these problems, because infighting and obsession with Trump's election denial have been at the center of several blow-ups. The most effective wing of the GOP apparatus right now, the National Republican Senatorial Committee, has succeeded by managing to create some insulation from Trump, allowing it to select strong candidates. In 2020, Republican congressional candidates mostly ran ahead of Trump. And even if Trump's theory of the RNC works out in 2024, what happens next? Trump will not always be the president or the nominee. Someday, Republicans will need to choose a new leader, and they may be left with only a shell of a party committee, gutted and stretched to be a part of Trump's personal election apparatus. It's a hard and long road to rebuilding from there. Just ask a Democrat. That completes the first article. The author, David Graham, is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and the title of his article was Trump Repeats Obama's Mistake. This next article comes to us from the health section, The Return of Measles. Cases are creeping up in America, and not because of politics, by Daniel Engber. Measles seems poised to make a comeback in America. Two adults and two children staying at a migrant shelter in Chicago have gotten sick with the disease. A sick kid in Sacramento, California, may have exposed hundreds of people to the virus at the hospital. Three other people were diagnosed in Michigan, along with seven from the same elementary school in Florida. As of Thursday, 17 states have reported cases to the CDC since the start of the year. For comparison, that total was 19, plus the District of Columbia, for all of 2023, and just 6 for 2022. We've got this pile of firewood, Matthew Ferrari, the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics at Penn State, told me. And the more outbreaks that keep happening, the more matches we're throwing at it. Who's holding the matchbook? There's an easy answer to who's at fault. One of the nation's political parties, and not the other, turned against vaccines to some extent during the pandemic, leading to voter disparities in death rates. One party, and not the other, has a presumptive presidential candidate who threatens to punish any school that infringes on parental rights by requiring immunizations. And one party, but not the other, appointed a vaccine-skeptical surgeon general in Florida who recently sidestepped standard public health advice in the middle of an outbreak. The message from Republicans, as the Washington Post's Alexandra Petri joked in a recent column, can sound like this: we want measles in the schools and books out of them. But the politics of vaccination, however grotesque it may be in 2024, obscures what's really going on. It's true that vaccine attitudes have become more polarized. Conservative parents in particular may be opting out of school vaccine requirements in higher numbers than they were before. In the blood-red state of Idaho, for example, more than 12% of kindergartners received exemptions from the rules for the 2022-23 school year, a staggering rate of refusal that is up by half from where it was just a year ago. Politicized recalcitrance is unfortunate, to say the least, and it can be deadly. Even so, America's political divides are simply not the cause of any recent measles outbreak. The virus has returned amid a swirl of global health inequities. Any foothold that it finds in the U.S. will be where hyper-local social norms, not culture war debates, are causing gaps in vaccine access and acceptance. The more this fact is overlooked, the more we're all at risk. Consider where the latest measles cases have been sprouting up. By and large, the recent outbreaks have been a blue state phenomenon. Idaho has so far been untouched. The same is true for Utah, with the nation's third highest school vaccination exemption rate. Zoom into the county level, and you'll find that the pattern is repeated. Measles isn't picking on Republican communities. If anything, it seems to be avoiding them. The recent outbreak in Florida unfolded not in a conservative area, such as Sarasota, where vaccination coverage has been lagging, but rather in Biden-friendly Broward County, at a school where 97% of the students have received at least one MMR shot. Similarly, the recent cases in Michigan turned up not in any of the state's MAGA-voting, vaccine-foregoing areas, but among the diverse and relatively left-wing populations in and around Ann Arbor and Detroit. Stepping back to look at the country as a whole, one can't even find a strong connection, or really any consistent link at all, between U.S. measles outbreaks year to year and U.S. children's vaccination rates. Sure, the past 3 years, for which we have student immunization data, might seem to show a pattern. Starting in the fall of 2020, the average rate of MMR coverage for incoming kindergartners did drop, if only by a little bit, from 93.9% to 93.1%. At the same time, the annual number of reported measles cases went up almost tenfold, from 13 to 121. But stretch that window back one more year, and the relationship appears to be reversed. In 2019, America was doing great in terms of measles vaccination. Across the country, 95.2% of kindergartners were getting immunized, according to the CDC. And yet, in spite of this fantastic progress, measles cases were exploding. More than 1,200 Americans got sick with the disease that year, as measles took its greatest toll in a generation. It's not that our high measles vaccination coverage didn't matter then, or that our slightly lower coverage doesn't matter now. Vaccination rates should be higher. This is always true. In the face of such a contagious disease, 95% would be good, 99% much better. When fewer people are protected, more people can get sick. In Matthew Ferrari's terms, a dropping immunization rate means the piles of firewood are getting bigger. If and when the flames do ignite, they could end up reaching farther and burning longer than they would have just a year or two ago. In the midst of any outbreak large enough, where thousands are affected, children will die. Despite America's fevered national conversation about vaccines, however, rates of uptake simply haven't changed that much. Even with the recent divot in our national vaccine rates, the country remains in broad agreement on the value of immunity. 93% of America's kindergartners are getting measles shots, a rate that has barely budged for decades. The sheer resilience of this norm should not be downplayed or ignored, or, even worse, reimagined as a state of grace from which we've fallen. Our protection remains strong. In Florida, the Surgeon General's lackadaisical response to the crisis at the Broward County Elementary School did not produce a single extra case of the disease, in spite of grim predictions to the contrary, almost certainly thanks to how many kids are already vaccinated. At the same time, however, measles has been thriving overseas. Its reemergence in America is not a function of the nation's political divides, but of the disease's global prevalence. Europe had almost 60,000 cases last year, up from about 900 in 2022. The World Health Organization reports that the number of reported cases around the world surged to 306,000 after having dropped to a record low of 123,000 in 2021. As the outbreak has made apparent, our world is connected via pathogens. Large outbreaks in other countries, where vaccination coverage may be low, have a tendency to seed tiny outbreaks in the U.S., where coverage has been pretty high, but narrow and persistent cracks in our defenses still remain. In 2022, more than half of the world's unvaccinated infants were concentrated in just 10 countries. Some of these are measles hotspots at this moment. This also helps explain why so many Americans got measles in 2019. That was a catastrophic year for measles around the world, with 873,000 reported cases in total, the most since 1994. We had pretty good protection then, but the virus was everywhere, and so the virus was here. In high-income countries such as the U.S., Ferrari told me, clustering of risk tends to be the source of measles outbreaks, more than minor changes in vaccine coverage overall. Even in 2019, when more than 95% of American kindergartners were getting immunized, we still had pockets of exposure where protection happened to be weakest. By far, the biggest outbreak from that year occurred among Hasidic Jewish populations in New York State. Measles was imported via Israel from the hot spot of Ukraine and took off within a group whose vaccination rates were much, much lower than their neighbors. In the end, more than 1,100 people were infected during that outbreak, which began in October 2018 and lasted for nearly a year. A national vaccination rate has some kind of meaning, but all outbreaks are local outbreaks. Noel Brewer, a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a member of the Federal Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, told me, "They happen on a specific street in a specific group of houses, where a group of people live and interact with each other, and those rates of vaccination in that specific place can drop well below the rate of coverage that will forestall an outbreak." We've seen this time and time again over the past decade. When bigger outbreaks do occur in the U.S., they tend to happen in tight-knit communities, where immunization norms are radically out of sync with those of the rest of American societies, politics aside. In 2014, when an outbreak of nearly 400 cases took hold in Ohio, almost entirely within the Amish community, the local vaccination rate was estimated to be about 14%. The statewide number for young children at that time was more than 95%. In 2011 and 2017, measles broke out among the large Somali American community in Minnesota, where anti-vaccine messaging has been intense and where immunization rates for two-year-olds dropped from 92% 20 years ago to 35% in 2021. An outbreak from the end of 2022 affecting 85 people in and around Columbus, Ohio, may well be linked to the nation's second biggest community of Somalis. Care must be taken in how these outbreaks are discussed. In Minnesota, for example, state health officials have avoided calling out the Somali community for fear of stigmatizing. But another sort of trouble may arise when Americans overlook exactly who's at risk and exactly why. Experts broadly agree that the most effective way to deal with local outbreaks is with local interventions. Brewer pointed out that during the 2019 outbreak in New York, for example, nurses who belonged to local Jewish congregations took on the role of vaccine advocates. In Minnesota, the Department of Health has brought on more Somali staff who coordinate with local Somali radio and TV stations to share its message. Yet these efforts can be obscured by news coverage of the crisis that points to a growing anti-science movement and parents giving up on vaccination all across the land. When measles spread among New York's Orthodox Jews, the New York Times reported on an anti-vaccine fervor on the left that is increasingly worrying health authorities. When the virus hit Columbus, NBC News noted that it was happening as resistance to school vaccination requirements is spreading across the country. Two different public health responses can be undertaken in concert, the experts told me. You treat the problem at its source, and you also take the chance to highlight broader trends. A spat of measles cases in one community becomes an opportunity for pushing vaccination everywhere. That's always an important thing for us to do, Ferrari said. Even so, the impulse to nationalize the problem will have its own infelicitous effects. First, it's meaningfully misleading. By catastrophizing subtle shifts in vaccination rates, we frighten many parents for no reason. By insisting that every tiny outbreak is a product of our national politics, we distract attention from the smaller measures that can and should be taken, well ahead of any upsurge of disease, to address hyper-local vaccination crises. And by exaggerating the scale of our divisions, by asserting that we've seen a dangerous shift on a massive scale, or an anti-vaccine takeover of the Republican Party, we may end up worsening the very problem that worries us the most. We are a highly vaccinated nation. Our politics, notwithstanding. Telling people otherwise only fosters more division. It feeds the feeling that taking or refusing measles shots is an important mode of self-expression. It further polarizes health behavior, which can only widen the cracks in our defenses. We have become quite militant and moralistic about vaccination, Brewer told me, and we probably would do well to be less absolute. Measles outbreaks overseas are growing. Measles outbreaks here will follow. Their specific causes ought not to be ignored. That's the end of the article. The author, David Engber, is a senior editor at The Atlantic. The title of his article, The Return of Measles. And I'll take just a brief minute to remind those of you that may have joined late, this is The Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your SunSounds volunteer reader today. I'm reading articles from the online edition of The Atlantic, all of them published in March of 2024. This article is from the family section of the magazine. The title, Marriage Proposals Are Stupid. This is no way for two grown humans to make a major life decision. By Caroline Kitchener. The marriage proposal is one of the most ritualized moments in modern American life. Growing up, many girls are instilled with a specific idea of how it should go. He'll take us somewhere romantic. We'll have no idea what's happening. He'll get down on one knee. We'll start crying. He'll pop the question. We'll immediately say yes. It should be magical. But for a lot of heterosexual couples, the proposal, as movies portray it, as many millennial women have internalized it, doesn't reflect the kind of modern, egalitarian relationships many women want today. Whom to marry is among the most important decisions most people will ever make in their lives, and yet it's not a choice made in the course of a conversation. The normal way two grown humans make big life decisions. Instead, it has to be a show with a prefixed grand finale, yes. Since the second wave of the feminist movement crested in the 1970s, almost every antiquated gender tradition in the United States has been seriously challenged, but not the proposal. It's been extremely resistant to change, said Stephanie Kuntz, a professor of marriage and family history at Evergreen State College. In the vast majority of proposals between heterosexual couples, it's still the man who asks the question. He makes this over-the-top attempt to show the woman that, even if we play things equally from here on out, in this we will be traditional, Kuntz adds. There is no time to pause, discuss, call friends for their advice, and think it over. You just have to know. In some ways, proposals do seem to be changing, but in the opposite direction. They're becoming less egalitarian, less conversation-like, and more elaborate and fantastical. Ellen Lamont, assistant professor of sociology at Appalachian State University, interviewed 105 people about their proposals. The women needed a story to tell their friends, Lamont said. There was more interest in the proposal being a public spectacle. If it was more of a conversation, it didn't have the same impact. She attributes this to social media. Now, when a couple gets engaged, the Facebook or Instagram post is an essential part of the process. Women want that perfect picture. Him down on one knee, her hand on cheek, surprised. Lamont says that most of the men in her study, on the other hand, profess to not caring about the details. They were like, whatever, I was going to propose anyway. If this is what makes her happy, I'm going to do it. For gay couples, these norms and the larger gender role partners are expected to enact in their relationship, are in flux. This particular conception of a proposal is solidified by American pop culture. There are hundreds of memorable proposal scenes in modern TV and movies, most of which follow a familiar script. Lamont says the opening scene of Sweet Home Alabama best encapsulates the quintessential proposal. Reese Witherspoon walks into Tiffany & Company, blindfolded. Her boyfriend uncovers her eyes, reveals the dozens of jewelers standing at attention, and tells her to pick one. Oh my God, she says, mouth wide open, stunned. Oh my God. When I ask why the proposal has been so slow to modernize, Lamont credited a phenomenon she calls symbolic gendering. Now that we expect women to be equal to men, women are looking for ways to distinguish gender in their lives. Within heterosexual romantic relationships, Lamont says, there is still a strong sense that women and men want different things, and by extension, should behave in different ways. As more women assume traditionally male roles at work, the traits that distinguish men and women in relationships become harder to see. A symbolic act like a proposal is a way to reenact those differences. Of course, many couples perform this particular ritual because it's fun and romantic. When a man plans an elaborate scheme to ask his girlfriend to marry him, when he builds a telescope or rents out a stadium, or presents his partner with a 17-carat diamond hidden inside a ring pop, a person is going to feel special. While many of the men in Lamont's study professed indifference to elaborate proposals, there's reason to think they appeal to men, too. Several recent studies show that men, particularly young men, feel intense pressure to hide how they're feeling. According to Judy Chu, a sociologist at Stanford who studies gender, young men today are so fixated on being a man that they end up missing what they each really want, which is just that closeness. A proposal is an occasion when it's socially acceptable, even encouraged, for men to be emotional, to lay it all on the line and show their partner how much she means to them. But responsible decisions aren't made in the moment. They're the product of dialogue and careful, measured consideration. Even if a couple is already living together, marriage is a big step. There are important questions to ask. How will finances work? Would you move across the country for a job? Will we have children? And if we do, will you change the diapers? When he's down on one knee with friends hiding in the bushes, there is no time to get answers or air doubts. And while most couples probably won't admit it, facing this particular milestone, doubts are normal. They don't mean you love your partner any less. Because elaborate proposals inhibit conversation, they pressure the person being asked to say yes. If the subject of marriage comes outside the context of a proposal, Kuntz says, a woman is free to tell her partner she isn't ready. But when the actual proposal comes, she told me, it's still so wrapped up in the old tradition of males taking initiative and females being delighted that it's very painful for everyone if it doesn't go the way we expect. For the woman who has to say no, for the man who feels humiliated, and for any public audience. Today, some couples will try to have both, the conversation and the show. They'll make sure they're on the same page about marriage, and then the woman will wait for the man to pick the perfect time and place. While this approach certainly helps, these conversations may be somewhat suffocated by the knowledge that a proposal is looming, and a desire to preserve some element of surprise for the big moment. When I proposed to my boyfriend, we had already talked beforehand. The proposal was lovely, but I still wonder if it was really necessary. But many couples do have these conversations, and the proposal route really is when the decision gets made, sometimes poorly. A few women in Lamont's study admitted that they said yes, even though they really didn't want to get married. Faced with an extravagant proposal, realizing how much work must have gone into it, they felt they had to choose between an engagement and a breakup. I felt like it would be saying no to the relationship rather than just saying no to the proposal, one woman told Lamont. I didn't think we could come back from that. As my colleague Megan Garber has written, women more so than men aggressively avoid awkward situations. Cultural forces, she writes, demand that they be accommodating, that they be pleasing, that they capitulate to the feelings of others and maintain a kind of sunny status quo. Just go with the flow, these forces suggest. Be chill. Get married. A marriage is, ideally, a partnership. It's two people playing life as a team. The proposal sets the tone for that partnership. Will you make the biggest, most important life decisions together, or will you make them apart? Talking about the kind of future you want to build, agreeing that it's time to take the next step, imagining where you'll be as a couple 50 years down the road. That's romantic. I'd take that conversation over a grand gesture any day. That's the end of the article. The author, Caroline Kitchener, is a former associate editor at The Atlantic and the author of Postgrad, 5 Women and Their First Year Out of College. The name of her article was Marriage Proposals Are Stupid. This next article from the Ideas section is titled QAnon for Wine Moms. Kate Middleton Needed Privacy. The Public Had Other Ideas, by Helen Lewis. There was a time not long ago when mainstream news consumers pitied people who had succumbed to the sprawling conspiracy of QAnon. Imagine spending your days parsing Q drops, poring over cryptic utterances for coded messages. Imagine taking every scrap of new information and weaving it into an existing narrative. These poor, deluded, terminally online saps. What a terrible modern affliction. And then some of my friends became Kate Middleton truthers. In January, the British royal family announced that Catherine, Princess of Wales, had needed surgery for unspecified, non-cancerous abdominal issues, and that her recovery would take longer than originally expected. She would therefore not assume public duties until after Easter. For several weeks, that explanation sufficed, but by late February, half the internet seemed to be speculating over her whereabouts, using the favored format of conspiracists everywhere, just asking questions. An absence is filled with puzzlement. What are we being told? And then larded with a garnish of suspicion. Why are they hiding the truth from us? In the past few weeks, my WhatsApp groups have been taken over by friends wondering what is wrong with the Princess of Wales. American acquaintances, perhaps assuming that my Britishness gives me some mystical connection to the Windsors, have started texting me for updates. Everyone has a theory. Everyone wants to know. But it's more than that. Everyone also seems mystified by the simple fact of not knowing. We have become so used to smartphone surveillance, oversharing on social media, and the commercial harvesting of life events for content that the prospect of remaining uninformed about the state of a stranger's intestines now seem like a personal affront. On March 4th, a grainy photograph of Kate, traveling in the passenger seat of a car with her mother, Carol, began to circulate, but it did not stop the speculation. Did her face look weird if you zoomed in to 20 times magnification? Yes, but then so would anyone's. Where was Prince William? Maybe with the kids? Was the photo staged, as in Weekend at Bernie's? Come on! Just to add fuel to the fire, that picture was not widely circulated in Britain. Again, what aren't we being told? Why are they hiding the truth from us? Over the weekend, the frenzy intensified when Kensington Palace released a photograph, supposedly taken by Prince William last week, of Catherine with her 3 children. Within hours, TikTok was full of momfluencers earnestly discussing the clumsy signs of editing on Prince Louis's pattern sweater. Someone on X, formerly Twitter, put the photo in an online tool that deemed it AI-generated. Someone else claimed in a post that went viral that the photo had been taken in November, based on the family involved wearing the same clothes that they did on a trip to a food bank, edited to be different colors for some reason. Another person jumped in to say that the shrub behind them was suspiciously green for early spring in England. And, oh look, she didn't appear to be wearing her wedding ring. These assertions sound plausible. and the sheer volume of them was self-reinforcing. But when I stopped to think, my brain somehow rewired itself. Why did I instinctively believe in such a thing as an online tool that can precisely calculate the probability of a photograph being AI-generated? Why would Kensington Palace cunningly edit a white sweater to be navy and then leave telltale signs of fakery, such as Princess Charlotte's impossible sleeve? When I read a suggestion that Kate's face had been lifted from her Vogue cover portrait, the spell broke. Maybe the faces looked the same, because they belonged to the same person? Late on Sunday night, though, the photo agencies that had distributed the picture issued a kill notice, stating that the level of digital editing meant that it did not meet their standards. The Kate Middleton truthers gleefully concluded that their suspicions had been validated. Britain's national newspapers, meanwhile, were furious. Most had splashed their front page with the image and now had to scramble to rewrite their coverage. One journalist who had written a column arguing that the photo had finally silenced all the absurd speculation updated it to observe that it had only raised more questions. Overzealous royal PR had taken a viral story and given it legitimacy. The essence of conspiracism is that innocent explanations do not exist, and neither do unlikely coincidences. Participants reject Occam's razor, the idea that the simplest explanation is usually correct. Which is more likely, that Catherine owns turtleneck sweaters in multiple colors, or that mysterious forces edited her white sweater to look navy to hoodwink onlookers? Conspiracists aren't stupid, because photo editing does exist, and celebrities do sometimes remove their wedding ring in lieu of issuing a statement about a separation. But it's revealing when the most lurid explanation is someone's default setting. Kate Middleton, trutherism, also feeds on the uncomfortable fact that mainstream media outlets don't tell the public everything, and those gaps and omissions become highly visible in a world of global news brands and lightly regulated social media. British newspapers are members of the Royal Rota, a system that grants close access to the Windsors in exchange for pooling reports and photographs with other media outlets. In practice, the threat of exclusion from the Rota also gives the royal PR team leverage to squash invasive or unwelcome stories. Prince Harry dropped out of it when he stepped back from being a working royal, and has since argued that it protected the core members of the family at his expense. U.S. news outlets aren't members of the Royal Rota, however, and American libel and privacy laws are much looser. That affects what they are prepared to publish. The result is that news consumers on both sides of the Atlantic can see that there are, in fact, things that the British papers aren't telling or showing them. On March 4th, when the first paparazzi pictures of Catherine were taken, British royal correspondents said that Kensington Palace had pressured them not to use the photographs because of privacy concerns. They complied, but the New York Post had no such qualms. And even American tabloids have limits on what they will publish, whereas social media platforms spread rampant speculation about the couple's marriage that neither British nor American newspapers will touch. The average TikTok user is not afraid of losing their place on the Royal Rota, nor of being sued. The current controversy demonstrates another tension between the royals and the press. News agencies have been unhappy for some time about politicians and royals supplying, quote, handout images instead of inviting journalists to take their own. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has an official photographer whose pictures, unsurprisingly, tend to make him look statesmanlike rather than silly. These are supplied to newspapers on days when no news images of Sunak are available, so they end up being widely used. Similarly, Kate Middleton is an enthusiastic amateur photographer who has taken many of her children's birthday portraits herself. By acting like this, Sunak and the princess have deprived working journalists of professional opportunities and editorial independence. For that reason, withdrawing the digitally altered royal photo probably wasn't a hard decision for photo agencies. They wanted to make a point. They also made the right call by doing so. In the era of deep fakes, transparency about where images come from and how they are created is more important than ever. Journalists have realized that much less is taken on trust these days. After the photo was withdrawn, an analysis of its metadata showed it was taken at Windsor, where the couple live, and edited twice in Adobe Photoshop. Catherine herself took the blame for the image, writing in a statement that, quote, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. Did this help? Of course not. All of 5 minutes passed before I saw someone just asking a new question. How did she have the time and energy to do all this photo editing while recovering from an operation? Two other factors have made this story so potent. The first is that visibility is a royal necessity. As the late Queen once said, she had to be seen to be believed. Monarchy, like the American presidency, also reduces power to a human scale, and so the state of Catherine's health is interesting for the same reason voters fret about Joe Biden's age. Both figures sit inside constitutional frameworks that limit their actions, and both, to be brutally honest, are replaceable. Yet the public fairly wants to know that Biden is in charge, not Kamala Harris, or the White House Chief of Staff, or Barack Obama, from a secret Kalorama lair. In the same way, members of royal families become blank canvases, allowing the rest of us to project our cultural anxieties onto them. The resulting characters are both very grand and very relatable. The wayward son, the embarrassing uncle, the scorned wife. They are also famous for being famous, and so their private lives are not their own. Connoisseurs of monarchy will recall a recent precedent for the Kate situation. In 2021, Princess Carlene of Monaco, married to Albert, an ex-playboy 2 decades her senior, with 2 children from casual relationships, suddenly left the principality and her young twins to spend 10 months in South Africa, where she grew up. The explanation for her absence started out as a conservation trip, then became recuperation for an ear, nose, and throat operation. When she returned to Europe, she checked into a Swiss clinic for exhaustion. The headlines about Carlene's condition were every bit as relentless as those surrounding Kate, but with a far smaller reach. On the other hand, the Windsors are a global brand. The second reason for the virality of Kate Middleton trutherism is that it is a classic Easter egg hunt, or if you prefer a more modern reference, it's an MMORPG, a massive multiplayer online role-playing game. Communities form around clues and symbols. Discrepancies in the prevailing narrative are identified. Dossiers are collated, and public statements are scoured for alleged omissions. and the atmosphere, as my colleague Charlie Warzel has written, is one of self-aware irony. Aren't we crazy to care about this so much? The underlying sense that none of this really matters enhances the sensation of playing a game. My social media feeds are regularly full of suggestions that say Biden has body doubles, and here are the 19 angled lines drawn on his face that prove it. Taylor Swift has become a master of dropping clues through clothes, color schemes, and coded lyrics. Or think of the thousands of hours of TikTok videos dedicated to Johnny Depp's libel action against Amber Heard. Her facial expressions in court were replayed and picked apart, along with every detail of their marital arguments. When a story becomes big enough, every outlet has to write about it, either to harvest the eyeballs and ad revenue on offer or just to prove that they, too, know it exists. Does this matter? Well, if you're the Princess of Wales or her family, it does. A request for privacy has morphed into a giant online game designed to invade it. But the story is also remarkable for the insight it gives us into the challenges facing traditional media. Trust is low, gatekeeping is impossible, and even people who probably once deplored tabloid intrusion into royal affairs and eating disorders are now firing up TikTok and getting suckered into a 9-part video series about the opacity of Princess Charlotte's sleeve. This is QAnon for wine moms, and the dynamics behind it are not going away. That ends the story, and the title was QAnon for Wine Moms by Helen Lewis. And that also ends the broadcast today. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your reader today. I've been reading from the online edition of The Atlantic. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the Broadcast Info and Audio button, and then click on Demand. You'll see a list of articles that are available. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for being with me today.